the president wants to spy on 200 million Americans without a warrant. Has he read this document, which he was sworn to uphold?
Now, I will not have you libel Abraham Lincoln.
I don't understand the problem with registering guns. We register cars.
Mark Levine brings you the news the government doesn't want you to know.
Today, an explosive story about connections between white supremacists and Islamic terrorists.
When there's a conflict between Scalia's conservative values and the Constitution of the United States, he throws away the Constitution.
When we do have secret prisons, that is not what America's all about.
Let's go to Mark in 5, 4, 3, 2.
Good evening, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. When you talk about global warming, people are all over the map. There are some on the left that talk about immediate doom. We're all going to die. There's nothing we can do. We're all in trouble. There are some on the right who deny it's even a problem, or if it is a problem, it's not man-made. In the middle are a bunch of experts talking a lot of complicated jargon that a lot of us find hard to understand. And then there's the politics of the matter. The House has passed a cap-and-trade bill. The Senate hasn't done so. What is in it? What helps the energy companies? What helps all of us? How do we really stop global warming and do so in a way that doesn't leave us as suckers, where we're the ones doing all the work and China and India, they're getting to pollute as much as they want? They're difficult questions, but I hope this hour you will learn all you need to know about global warming, the politics behind it, and what we can do all over the world to stop it. I have two guests today, both from the Truman National Security Project. Sitting to my immediate left is the COO, the Chief Operating Officer of the Truman National Security Project, John Powers. And sitting to his left is Jim Moran. He's an attorney. He's a someone who's done a lot of work on structuring renewable energy deals. And both gentlemen to my left are veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan.
I'm just Iraq.
You're just Iraq, and you're Iraq.
And I had the privilege of doing both.
And one of the things that interested me most was the belief of the Truman Project and of both of you individually that this is a national security issue.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, let's start with what's the real problem. A lot of Americans see the Arctic ice cap falling apart, and apparently now we can go. We have the Northwest Passage. We can actually travel around. You know, why is this a bad thing?
Well, you know, it's not just the Arctic ice cap. It's an increase in droughts, a decrease in drinking water and availability. It's an increase in storms. Look at the north of Africa right now, and Lake Chad, which is the largest drinking source for that area, is down to 5% of its original value. And because of that, you've got to struggle for simple but scarce resources. That in a place that has an unfragile government, like Sudan or Somalia, or even Chad now that the issues of Darfur are beginning to cross the border, you're going to have extremist groups coming in and taking advantage of those fragile governments as people are just trying to fight just to get drinking water and stay alive.
So how does that affect the United States of America? How does that affect consumers? I mean, there's always been wars all over the globe. There's always been people fighting for scarce resources. How does this affect Americans?
Well, I think one of the most important things to understand is that our country's always seen that it has a special role in the world. It seems pretty obvious to me, Senator John Warner said the same, that as these crises get exacerbated by global warming, as war becomes more scarce in Palestine, as you know, pestilence and insects become more of a problem in sub-Saharan Africa, cutting down food growth, food production, by over a third in some cases, depending on some predictions, the United States and its peers, but particularly the United States as a leader of those peers, is going to be called to help deal with that ensuing humanitarian crisis and the strife that follows from that.
And the reality is that there was just a recent report put out by the Center for Naval Analysis where they brought together a military advisory board of generals and admirals who talked about the fact that, you know, climate change acts as a threat multiplier. So places, you know, we know what happened to us here on September 11th when an extremist group went into a fragile state, established base camps, trained folks that ended up being able to hit us, which has really created a new threat that we've been trying to fight. Now, we know the last 8 years we didn't fight it in the right way, but that's besides the point. And what we're doing is we're creating more opportunities and more pockets for those extremist groups to come in. And by doing that, we've just multiplied the threat that we're facing.
So the Arctic ice, as it melts, we expect there to be greater dangers, hurricanes, flooding, more events like Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah, absolutely.
Small island nations can be totally wiped out. In fact, I think there was one recently.
Well, several other islands in the Pacific are looking at plans of how they can move their entire population. I believe Kiribati is one of them, because they are very, you know, barely above seawater, and in the last 10, 15 years, since 1993, sea level rise has doubled over the historical average. So that means bad things for not only Pacific Islanders, but also residents of Virginia Beach, our coastline, as well as military bases, domestic and overseas. The Navy recently did a report at Diego Garcia, which is a large bomber base in the middle of the Indian Ocean, flew the missions that supported my infantry platoon in Afghanistan. That island is significantly challenged by rising seas.
And if you look at the results of some of these massive storms, now we can, you know, obviously the tsunami that hit in Indonesia wasn't a climate change causing effect, but it was a major storm that we had to react to. And we reacted to in a sense that the American military was putting out $5 million a day by helicopters and ships and troops on the ground. Now why does it matter? Why does it matter that we went into Indonesia to help? Well, Indonesia is the most populous Muslim country in the world. And it's a place that struggles with extremist groups trying to find a wedge. But the American public, the American military coming in and putting a good footprint down and helping out definitely helps our image abroad. It helps establish us as a friend to the folks on the ground there. And in the long term, it really helps our national security here at home.
Okay, but John and Jim, you both know the conservative argument. So they'll tell you that there's always been hurricanes, there's always been storms, there's always been global shortages, there's always been, you know, climates have certainly changed. We had an ice age a few million years ago. How do we know that it is man's carbon production that is causing the current crisis? And how is this worse than any other heating or cooling trend in the planet over the last 100, 500 years?
Well, coming from a national security perspective first, I'm not a scientist. So, you know, obviously the science has put out there. The UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has put out almost completely supported science to the point that even the conservatives came about not too long ago, and most of them are admitting it's true. You know, the folks that are fighting this now, some of them were denying this even existed just a few years ago. But from a military and national security perspective, you can't wait until a threat completely shows itself. When there's a risk, you've got to address that risk. And the risk has gotten so strong that even the Pentagon has done a report on it. The national intelligence agencies have done an estimate on the challenges of climate change. The risk is there. So from a national security perspective, we've got to figure out how to best move forward, how to address it, not only address the results of climate change, but address the root causes of fossil fuels and our energy security.
Okay, well, let's talk about the root causes. What causes global warming?
Essentially, it comes down to, and there's a variety of depth you can give this explanation at, but it comes down to greenhouse gases. There are certain gases, the most common of them, of course, is CO2, carbon dioxide, but others are carbon fluorocarbons, and then methane gas. And these gases, when they rise to a historically unprecedented state, since they're trapped in by the Earth's atmosphere, increase the heat. And this has happened throughout geology, as the scientists have showed in a variety of studies, and that coincides with a rising of the temperature.
Are we at unprecedented levels? The Earth has undergone dramatic heating and cooling long before humans came on the planet. But let's talk about sort of recorded history, the last, 4,000 to 6,000 years or so. Are we at unprecedented levels within that range?
I think we're at unprecedented levels in terms of carbon in the atmosphere, which is caused by, you know, the Industrial Revolution that was kicked off here at home. And by putting out those levels and not the challenge that we've failed here from ourselves as American citizens is addressing that when we saw it coming. You know, we saw it coming in the 1970s. We saw everything from the fuel shortages to the beginning of, you know, Al Gore started his campaign back, you know, late 60s, early 70s. It wasn't a new thing when he won the Oscar. But we didn't act on it. We didn't move the levels of mileage your car gets per gallon of gas.
The CAFE standards.
CAFE standards,
them.
Exactly. We didn't elevate those for decades. The car companies lobbied against it. They didn't want to invest in the long-term results. And now, you know, look, foreign car companies that did invest in that, you know, are now sort of kicking our butt. So,
and now we see that I'm told by the scientists there's sort of a multiplier effect. That once the Arctic ice starts melting, then the cooling of the Arctic ice used to help keep the planet cool. And so it actually, the same amount of carbon gas 10 years ago, today actually causes more damage than it did 10 years ago.
In our sense, some of that has to do with the natural weather patterns in that the effects are always felt more strongly up at the north end of the Earth or the southern end at the poles and the center, just the way that the water and the ocean circulates as well as the prevailing winds. But what we've been waiting for the last 20 years is better and better science. And we keep getting it, and it keeps confirming this realization that is our activity that is causing the world to warm. So in a way to think about it is, it's like keeping a pile of kerosene rags in your kitchen. And you keep piling and keep piling because you're waiting to find out, you know, will my stove light these up? Well, they're getting really close now. And I think almost without exception, particularly without exceptions funded by the Petroleum Institute, you find that scientists are telling us that pile of rags is very, very close to the stove. Is it really worth continuing the course we're on?
Well, here's the problem with global warming and cleaning it up. It's a global problem. It's very hard to find any global solutions to practically anything. There are always going to be rogue nations. There are always going to be nations that don't play by the rules. And it kind of reminds me like, a bunch of people in a field and everyone has to pick crops. Well, it's backbreaking work to bend down and pick the crops. And if your neighbors are picking the crops, if Europe is doing the hard work, that helps the problem. Sure, if we're doing the hard work, that helps the problem. But China and India aren't doing it. Well, that harms the problem. And you know, the Kyoto Accords, one of the great criticisms of them was that even though it did have limits on industrialized nations, the United States, Canada, Europe, Japan, and so forth, it allowed China and India to pollute at will, and that's why the Senate didn't ratify the treaty.
That's largely true, but one of the things it did do is create a clean development mechanism, which has been as the object of a variety of praise and criticism ever since. But what that does is allows developed nations, largely in Europe, but Japan, Canada, would have been us had we signed,
We ratified.
You're right. Because, of course, so much of that structure of that agreement was our desire. It's very much a U.S.-created document that the U.S. just decided not to ratify at the last minute.
The Clinton administration
precisely
had to negotiate it.
And particularly with the Senate. But the Clean Development Mechanism allows developed nations to buy credits from developing nations, particularly China and India. And what that has done is soften the impact on those developed nations, but also allowed those nations to grow in a way that is more environmentally sustainable.
And if you look at globally, obviously the Americas a leader. And we're the international leader from a military perspective. We know we've been on the ground in places and fought along other countries, and we know where we stand in this world, and we've got to lead. We've got to lead. I know you heard me talk about my Senate testimony. We've got to lead by example and set the standard for the rest of the world to follow. But also here at home, we have the educational base, the academic base, to develop the technologies to move us out of this predicament. That you know, China's making the moves in the right direction there. India's making the moves in the right direction. But the undeveloped countries don't have the industrial base, the technological base to turn to and say, let's try to find a way to solve this. And as we moved into the new legislation, we moved into a new era of climate change, we're beginning to put a price on carbon to provide incentives to begin to invest in those technologies and to move us away.
Well, we're going to have a lot to talk about this hour. I want to specifically talk about the details of the cap and trade legislation, what it does, what it doesn't do, what's intended to do, what does cap and trade mean at all, why is that an important concept. I want to get into what China and India are doing, are there ways to control what they're doing, and how the problem's increasing. And I also want to talk with you, Jim, later on about some of the things that you've done to structure renewable energy. I know you've talked to me about not just wind, but a very interesting way to trap methane gas and actually use this pollutant to help fuel things, which is an amazing idea. Folks, I also want you to join in. If you have any question about this, any comment, I encourage you to call in. You can agree or disagree. 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. Back after this.
This is firstgov.gov, where we're obsessed with getting you government information.
Brand new student loan applications on the site, baby.
This calls for a celebration.
Here's your uncle.
So in the end, it was either take the astronaut gig or come work here. What can I say? Duty called.
Dude, that's my cop.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. No, I'm pretty sure that's Sam's cop.
Oh, sorry?
Yeah. No. Sam's. No.
Just log on or email us and get what you need.
C, change of address form. That's how it's done.
D, driver's license renewal.
Mm-hmm. E, emailing social security information.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Nice, we'll allow it. All right, F.
What are those?
Government surplus cars for auction.
You posted those online last time.
No, you did.
I'm posting them online this time!
For all your government information, FirstGov.gov.
Oh, what have we got here? Sometimes you feel tired. You can't seem to lose those extra pounds off your midsection. And your joints hurt when you take the stairs. Well, you're getting older. But I'm happy to say that there's some simple things we can do to keep you happy and healthy for years to come. We can also lower your risk for some serious diseases the older population is often subject to. Proper nutrition is more important than ever. Your body has changed, you know. Not as many treats. A basic exercise plan, lots of walks and fresh air. And most importantly, come and see me for twice yearly checkups to help ensure the best possible quality of life. Now, how does that sound? Good boy.
Improve the quality of life for your elderly pet. Schedule twice yearly checkups that include preventive care and regular lab work. A message from the veterinary members of the American Animal Hospital Association.
Here again, the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. What do you know about global warming? What do you know about the cap and trade bill? Will it harm our economy? Will it help our economy? How will it affect our national security? What do we do about other nations that are cheating? There are lots of questions here. And frankly, a lot of people are looking at the United States askance, like Europe and Japan, saying, we followed the ball, we went with Kyoto, we reduced our emissions. How come you haven't done the same? Trying to address all of these issues, I have John Powers, the CEO of the Truman National Security Project, and I have Jim Morin, who is an attorney who's worked on renewable energy projects and also a veteran. Gentlemen, we were talking before the break about the Kyoto Treaty and what it did and what it didn't do. Do we need a new Kyoto? Coming up in just a few weeks, I believe, is the Copenhagen conference. What is going on there? Will it differ from Kyoto?
Yeah, it's in December.
December, okay.
I think what part of the world is sort of watching to see what we do now. You know, the House moved this past summer and passed some of the first legislation we've had on this in a long time, the American Clean Energy and Security Act. And the Senate's begin to make the same move. So we're sort of in a position where we're positioning our leadership on this leading into the conference. It's an incredibly important conference. It will be a new Kyoto Treaty. It'll be setting the standards for the rest of the world to follow. But one of the key pieces, we talked earlier about India and China. And one of the key parts about being a leader is accepting maybe these other countries won't do exactly the same thing we do, but at least give them some guidelines to work in, give them a framework, and set the standard that you're showing. You know, obviously both being military guys and having been leading soldiers in combat, it's the leaders that led by example, not the leaders that lead by rank, that the soldiers follow into combat. And we as a nation, unfortunately for the last 8 years, have been leading by rank and are ready to move past that. And I think we've seen a new light with this administration in that fashion.
Well, let's talk specifically about the cap and trade bill. It's one that passed fairly quickly in the House. It still has trouble in the Senate. Largely, it's been overshadowed by the health care debate. But it's one of those bills that, like most bills in Congress, is incredibly long, is incredibly complex. There are those on the left that say it didn't go far enough, that it's giving way too many goodies to energy. What exactly did the House do? Jim?
What it did do was take a giant step forward in creating a framework that will allow this country to move towards a better energy future, a cleaner one, a more secure one. And
let's give details. Cap and trade, the whole point of it, as I understand it, is that you cap the amount of pollutants, in this case carbon, in the air. And you say you could have only so much carbon, 1,000 parts per whatever. And then you say, if you want to pollute because it does a lot of good for you and you make a lot of money polluting, then you can sell your offsets to someone else who perhaps can do something more cheaply. And this, to me, as you know, I was an economics major undergrad. So one of the things we learned in economics is that if you can trade these things, it's more efficient than simply saying, well, everyone gets only 2 parts per billion. Because I may have something that makes me a lot of money, and I make 4 parts per billion, and you may have something you can do more cheaply if you can pay for those offsets. I mean, that's the whole sort of economic.
Exactly. It started off as an economist's daydream back in the 80s.
Right.
And somehow it worked its way in 1990 into the Clean Air Act, specifically for sulfur dioxide, SO2.
And so we already have a cap and trade system for sulfur dioxide.
It is an American idea that Americans pioneered and have demonstrated to the world how it can work.
Well, let's talk about sulfur dioxide. Is that the thing that used to cause acid rain between the United States and Canada?
It sure used to. What was the last time you heard about it?
I haven't heard about acid rain in 15 years.
Because what the SO2 trading program did was create this system where people who figured out the best way to reduce their SO2 then could sell the emissions to the people who were a little slower about figuring it out.
And so it really harnessed... So the idea is if you have a plant that creates very little sulfur dioxide, you get rewarded. And if you have a plant that creates a lot of sulfur dioxide, you got to pay because that pollutant causes problems.
And it puts a price on it. That's the key. And it puts a price that you can use to trade. It puts a price that you can use as leverage. And it provides an incentive for these companies to work away from it. That wasn't there before. And I think that's what happened with acid rain, and that's what will happen with carbon.
You're right that it was an economist's dream. It's one of the things that we study when we study economics is the problem of pollution. It's a free rider problem. The free rider problem in economics is basically when you cause a problem and you don't have to pay for it. In other words, if I make something but it causes you to cough and your water to be bad, that harms you, but if I don't pay for it, it's not a cost to me, it's a cost to you. That's unfair. So you have to re-sort of internalize the cost and say, hey, if you're going to pollute, you have to pay for it.
It goes to the fundamentals of what economics can be. If you go back to the medieval ages, you know, there used to be, people didn't own land. You just grazed your animals wherever you wanted to. What people found is they didn't take care of the land they didn't own. So they created privately owned land. And our market capitalist structure has built up around that. But the problem is, we always treated the air like we used to treat pasture land, as if it would just always be there and be able to bear some unbelievable amount of pollution. We've realized that's not the case. And so what cap and trade does is creates a structure that creates a price so that people start realizing this is a valuable earth and I'm going to take care of my part of it, or I'm going to pay a little extra to pay for that luxury.
And there's actually companies out there today that are looking to find ways so your viewers at home can figure out how they're managing their own carbon and actually make money off this.
And it's make money off of managing your own carbon?
Yeah, and selling your carbon credits to companies that can't manage
their own. How can an individual sell their carbon?
Your home. You've got carbon in your home.
Give me an example.
If an example is if you insulate your home and you cut down on the energy input, then you're actually saving carbon. There is a group out there right now figuring out how to price that, how to set it up so that they can get an organization to host that carbon and basically buy it from you. So you'll get a check every month for what you've done.
Now, is this happening now, or is this some future dream?
Well, happens to some extent in California now, where your meter in California and several other states spins backwards. If you put a solar panel on your roof, if you generate electricity somehow at home, you are putting electricity back into the grid.
So you can actually, you have a negative energy use. You have a solar panel on your home.
My cousins are dairy farmers up in Western New York, and they now have a system in place where they capture the manure from the cows, and they put it into a burner, and they are selling energy. They fuel their entire farm based on this. And they do over 1,500 head of cow 3 times a day.
And they say that BS has no value. Yeah.
And they're selling it back, they sell it back to the grid. They're selling that energy back to the grid and actually making money off it.
And you were telling me about something that a project you worked on that trapped methane gas?
Yes, this was actually in Mexico doing this at a massive scale. Again, through the Clean Development Mechanism, the CDM that was created by the Kyoto Protocol. Mexico, very much being a developing nation, has that right to sell to other countries those credits. And so a variety of these projects have been created where they create enormous, essentially, plastic bubbles. And in there, they fill manure from pig farms nearby the border, or near that plant, that manure decomposes, as it were, releasing methane, which, keep in mind, methane is considerably worse greenhouse gas than CO2 is, 23 times as much, given the chemistry. And so when you capture it, you get 23 times as much of the credits for every ton of gas. And again, it's also a very potent fuel for generating even more electricity. So this is just an example.
So here we're taking the ultimate waste product and using it in a productive way.
Exactly. Once you've given people a reason to. Once you've given them that price stimulus.
Well, why do they need a price stimulus at all? I mean, if you can make anything go using manure, why not do so without government help?
Because there hasn't been a price on that carbon. There hasn't been a price on that energy for you to trade back. And what the cap and trade system is doing, and like I think Jim hit it perfectly before, there's nothing more American. It is driving the American entrepreneur to go out and figure out ways that they can tap into this market, this free market, and trade back into the system. And by setting these standards, we can go into Copenhagen and say, look, we're doing it. Let's set up an international market. So as we begin to cut down on our carbon, and China, for instance, begins to raise theirs, even though they are now about to surpass us in wind power. That's how they're really driving ahead in their own investment there. It'll give us an ability to trade, an ability to actually to make money off of it.
Okay, so I understand the theory. I think you'll find even conservatives support the theory of cap and trade. But then the devil's in the details. And you will hear lots of complaints about the bill that the House just passed. You will hear complaints, lots of them. I hear them all the time. I do a show on Pacifica Radio. And they say it's a sop to industry. It hasn't done anything. It's hardly going to make any change. This is just, we're hardly doing anything at all. And then you see conservatives saying it's going to destroy the economy. We're in terrible shape. It's going to destroy business. So what's the truth? How did the House do? How do you grade the bill that they've passed so far?
Maybe a way to know that it's a well-written bill is that nobody likes it. For the environmentalists, it is a little too slow. For conservatives and other carbon skeptics or greenhouse climate
change skeptics. Or businesses that pollute.
It seems maybe a little bit fast. And I think what Congress has been struggling to do is hit that balancing point. And I think this bill gets pretty close. And if it passes, we'll know if it gets close enough.
And it's a step in the right direction. We're actually making the motion. I mean, if you look back again in the 70s when people were lining up for gas, there was all the talk. They put solar panels in the White House, but we went away from that. We let it go. Oil prices dropped, and people forgot about the long-term effects of what they're doing. And now, I mean, we talked a lot about the results of climate change and but looking back at what's caused it, and it's our addiction to foreign oil, which is not only costing us billions of dollars that we're sending overseas to folks like Ahmadinejad in Iran or Chavez in Venezuela, but it's costing us lives in a place like Iraq.
And I'm going to get to that after the break, because there's some, like conservative columnist Kathleen Parker, who thinks you have it exactly wrong. So we'll talk about that. But before we go to the break, I just want to ask you, you gave testimony Thursday, before the Senate Environmental and Public Works Committee. The bill has passed the House. Is it going to pass the Senate? Are the Republicans going to filibuster? Will they get 60 votes?
I certainly hope so. I mean, part of the reason we went up there is to go at folks who may not be with the environmentalists on the left and need a way to look at this and say, how can I support this bill? And I went with a Republican
from
Virginia.
Why would a centrist, a moderate, a blue dog Democrat, a moderate Republican, why should they support the bill?
Because it's an issue of national security. We don't address this problem now. Our troops will be addressing it down the road. And again, every day we're sending over billions of dollars.
The toll-free number is 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. This is live television. You can join the debate, ask a question, get an answer to something you really don't know a lot about, or just give us your opinion, 888-488-6275. Back after this.
Art, a universal language, an expression of culture, of self. And now, thanks to Empowered Women International, a way for emerging and established immigrant and refugee artists and artisans to find hope to earn a living while enriching the lives of all of us. Empowered Women International, making a better America every day. For more information on Empowered Women International's educational programs, or to make a tax-free donation, contact cfripp@aol.com.
It would be easy to tell which kids have trouble with their eyesight. But that's not always the case. Even though one in four children may have a vision problem, eye doctors tell us the symptoms aren't always so obvious. We do know that 80% of all childhood learning is visual. And without good vision, kids can have trouble learning to read. And may fall behind in school. For clues on how to spot the real-life signs of childhood vision problems, and what parents can do, visit checkyearly.com. A public service message from the Vision Council of America, and reading is fundamental.
Here again, the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. We're discussing global warming, but specifically what is being done, both in the United States and abroad, to stop it. The two gentlemen to my left, my two guests, argue that it's a national security question, not just a scientific question. They are John Powers, he's the COO of the Truman National Security Project, and Jim Morin, it's Morin or Morin? I want to get it.
Morin.
I got it right the first time. Jim Morin, an attorney who's worked on a number of renewable energy projects. Both of them are veterans of the Iraq War, the Iraq and Afghani War, and they argue this is necessary to our national security. Jim, I want to ask you about some of the projects you've worked on. You mentioned methane, you've done wind. You help structure these deals, is that what you do as an attorney?
Correct. There are a variety of people that will really do well with this legislation. And some of it is American energy entrepreneurs, the people who are figuring out this technology. But others are American farmers. Up to $24 billion of offsets may be sold to farmers. They'll do a variety of things. They'll capture methane from their animal manure.
Is this all in the House bill?
Yes, yes it is. And other ways, if they change their cultivation techniques to trap more carbon in the soil instead of just leaving it exposed.
There's a lot of things like that. Now, why can't we just leave the free market to do this? I mean, if wind is profitable, people will buy wind farms. Why do we need the government to be involved at all?
Well, I think one of the challenges is the fact that it hasn't, to be perfectly honest with you. I mean, we're at a point now that we're almost at a critical mass, that we've got to take action. So the free market hasn't made the moves. But what the cap and trade does is opens up to the free market, and it provides incentives to begin to invest in wind or solar. One of the problems was, for too long, we were putting out incentives that were short-term. You know, here's a one-year tax break to invest in wind. Here's a one-year tax break to invest in solar. And then every year, we were renewing it. But the problem is, if I'm a venture capitalist, I don't want to bet on a one-year gig. I want to look long-term and figure out where that money is. So as bad as our economy is right now, there is a lot of money getting ready to move in this direction and put the investment forward. The problem is it hasn't had a mechanism to do that, and I think this bill is a good start in that direction.
And that's particularly true when you talk about utilities, because everybody's got a cousin or an uncle who has this ancient car that he dumps all kinds of money into to fixing it piece by piece, whereas he could have just bought a new one a long time ago. But that's similar to the way renewable energy is. It's very expensive to build. Wind projects are very expensive to put up, but they're free afterwards, except for a little bit of maintenance cost here and there. But what the American...
So the infrastructure needs help.
Exactly. And it needs a push in the right direction, because financiers, banks, Wall Street, are very familiar with a coal generation plant, very familiar with a gasification plant. And that really reflects policy decisions made by this country years and years ago. But what this allows us to do is create a framework that people know that they can make those bets. Congress is putting its money where its mouth is.
And I think a really great metaphor for this, which is unfortunate truth, in Iraq and Afghanistan today, 70% of our convoys that are going in and out are for fuel and water. 70%. And having both been on convoys and I've definitely lost soldiers over there, and the convoys is where we're losing most of our casualties. What piece of equipment do you think uses most of that fuel?
I assume a tank. I don't know.
Generators. Oh. And the fact that we haven't invented a solar power generator yet in a place like Iraq, Afghanistan?
Yeah, that's strange.
Doesn't seem backwards.
There's a lot of heat. It would be very easy to have a solar power generator.
But in the Defense Department, there was no one accountable for energy.
There must be solar power generators. Someone must have developed one.
Well, there
haven't the Japanese done it by now?
Well, certainly you can generate power through solar panels.
Right.
It happens every day.
Right.
But what is unique and what is changing is things like insulating tents overseas and throwing a solar panel on top of it. So you don't have to bring
having a mobile, something that you can just put up in a moment.
Exactly.
Absolutely right. And I think the key is putting the incentives behind it, finding those equipment and getting it. It's going to save lives. It's going to save us billions of dollars. For every $10 increase in the price per barrel of oil, which has gone from $30 back in December to $65 yesterday, you've seen it's a $1.3 billion increase for the defense budget per $10, which is the entire procurement budget for the Marines. So we are costing our military billions by being addicted to the oil like we are, which, again, is the root cause
Let me ask you this. We had a call during the break from Mike from Centerville, Virginia, and he wanted to know about nuclear power. Nuclear power doesn't have carbon waste. It has nuclear waste, but it doesn't seem to pollute our air. What do you think about nuclear power?
I think if we don't find a way to secure the waste, which is a huge problem, especially with proliferation, I mean, even look at our nuclear weapons, you know, which is nuclear warheads. You think the military has a grip on them. We would never lose one. Just a couple of years ago, we lost six for a 24-hour period. The Air Force
flying to North Dakota. I remember
right.
that.
So not only do you have to secure the waste, but you also have to secure a way that the fuel is handled. And I don't think we've yet defined that. I think the options are on the table. There is no silver bullet to replace oil. You know, it's going to be a mixture of solar, of wind, of hydroelectric. And if we have to discuss nuclear, I think it's going to be an option we have to look towards. But right now, the science or the security aspect of that isn't there.
Also, if we're going to lead the world, I would hate to think we're leading the world in nuclear power when there are a lot of nations who might use it for bad purposes.
Oh, but keep in mind that the nuclear fuel that's used to generate electricity is extremely different from the uranium used in nuclear weapons. And so the world has come a long, long way from the days of Three Mile Island. And the world was a long, long way ahead of Chernobyl at the time. My grandfather was a nuclear physicist for the Navy, did nuclear safety. And he told me as a young man about going to an energy conference, international energy conference. And there was a stack of papers from the United States and a stack of papers from France, and there was one from the Soviet Union. So I think, you know, looking at Chernobyl as an example in some ways is looking at the kid that didn't do his homework all through school and deciding, well, I probably shouldn't go either because he failed out.
Well, but that's the fear when it comes to global warming. That's the fear that the United States will do its homework. The reason it was Senator Helms of North Carolina who passed the amendment saying we're not going to agree to Kyoto. It was the amendment was passed, I think, 95-0 or something. And they said, basically, we're afraid of the kid that doesn't do his homework. China and India aren't prohibited under this. We are. Will Copenhagen put limits on China and India as well?
Well, I think that's got to be part of the negotiation moving forward. But look at from a national security perspective. Again, you know, I'm not a scientist. I'm not going into these negotiations. But China and India doesn't respond to global crisis. It's not their military going out. So from a pure soldier's perspective, when there's going to be fighting in Somalia because there's a lack of scarce resources and extremist groups are going to set up camps, which may come back to hit us someday. I don't expect China's military to show up.
No, but if we reduce our carbon footprint by 16%, and the statistics I've seen in the last 10 years or so, we've increased ours by about 16%. China's increased theirs by 150%. India by more than 100%. They are doubling in 2.5 times. Whatever reductions we get here through hard work and cap and trade and sacrifice and all that, and not just the United States. I mean, frankly, Europe and Japan have gone far further than we have. But if we do it and China and India pollute and have another coal-fired nuclear, a coal-fired plant, which they're very common in China right now,
sure.
They can undo all the good we've done, right?
I mean, keep in mind that China's been putting up one every 5 days, a new coal plant.
One new coal plant every 5 days.
But the bottom line is that we are still the number one emitter. China's getting pretty close.
Statistics I said that showed that as of 2008 they passed us. But we're very close.
And you're right. That did slip my mind.
So we're barely number two. But of course they have a few more people.
But the bottom line is, you know, you are in this, like everything else, you lead, follow, or get out of the way. Right now we're in the way instead of leading the way, which to me is what Americans do.
And if you can show a way to set it up to where it'll be profitable, if you can show a way that their entrepreneurs can get in behind just as strongly, China recognizes this. I don't know if you've ever been overseas, but we were in Beijing just before the Olympics and went to a place called Xi'an, and you could not see to the end of the street because of the pollution.
So polluted.
Yeah, they recognize that they're going to have to do something. But again, we've got to put the incentives out there to develop the technologies. You know, one of the challenges on ethanol, which, you know, Bush talked about in the State of the Union a few years ago, he went from not believing in global warming to saying ethanol is the only way to go. We put all our money in it for a while and we had food shortages. So instead of stepping back and looking for a reasonable approach, developing a multi-pronged adventure into what we're doing, then we're not going to expect other countries to move in that direction as well. So I think Jim's right. We've got to set the standard. We've got to begin to lead.
I've studied ethanol. My understanding is it's a big failure, honestly, that it just doesn't give us the bang for the buck. It was a nice try, but it just certainly doesn't give us for the cost the right kind of fuel reduction, and it's become a political football. It helps farmers and so forth.
But
is it a failure, ethanol?
No, I think it's very much like grading a student on the first quarter of the year. Corn-based ethanol has a lot of problems, but there are so many technologies that are being developed now.
So there's other ethanol, maybe switchgrass or something like that.
Or even things like algae-based. I think the bottom line here is that there is one thing that Americans have always done better than other countries, and it's innovate and create. And if we're not doing it in this response to this crisis, China sure will and India sure will. And they're working very hard now to do exactly that.
And corn base is a 1.0 version of what we've got to get to. But, you know, like just like Microsoft, you had to have 1.0 to get to 2.0 and 2.0 to get to 3.0. And we're beginning to move in that direction. But, again, it was a first step. And we've got to begin to make more and more steps.
Now, conservative columnist Kathleen Parker wrote in the Washington Post just a few days ago a very powerful article arguing exactly the opposite of what you two are arguing, saying that you may support a cleaner earth, you may want to stop global warming, that's all well and good, but actually for national security reasons, it's exactly the opposite. She argued the cap and trade bill would cause us to use more foreign fuel. Now, we all agree, whether it's you, the three of us, or Kathleen Parker, that we want to get away from foreign oil. None of us want to give more money to Chavez and to Iran and to Russia. So all of us agree. Conservatives, liberals, I think you'll find 99% of Americans want to get away from foreign oil. But there's a bitter dichotomy as to how you do that. You two say cap and trade gets us away from foreign oil. She says cap and trade leads us to be more reliant on foreign oil.
Well, first of all, I would completely disagree with the premise of her argument. The reality is, EPA has done an evaluation of this bill and says that by 2020 we'll have moved away 150 billion barrels, $24 billion worth a year, and because of this bill. Because
the EPA has said
EPA
that.
Their studies have shown that's the direction we'll move in.
The Environmental Protection Agency.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Parker's piece really is a classic example of the problem that conservatives have with this bill, and that they don't realize that maybe we're not going to use gasoline to fuel our cars 40 years from now. The American auto fleet turns over almost every 10 years. I think actually maybe a little bit less. Why are we necessarily going to be using entirely gasoline?
Parker's argument is that the bill, cap and trade, deals with stationary electricity creating things like coal plants fossil fuel burning, fuel oil plants, nuclear plants. It deals with stationary things. And it doesn't address cars, which create so much of the carbon dioxide in the air.
And that's not exactly true. There's a large section of the bill dedicated to clean transportation. And
there is. So she's just wrong on that.
So she is wrong. It is not a robust contribution, to be honest.
We could have more.
And she is right when she points out that. I mean, one of the things about this bill is that, as conservatives like to call it jumping off a cliff, in a lot of ways it's more like stepping onto a Kansas City sidewalk. It is a very gradual transition to a new economy. But there's good reasons for that. It's because we're not trying to put too much pain on American consumers.
So maybe we need both and. We need cap and trade, and we need to increase CAFE standards.
Which the president talks about.
Which has already been done in recent bills. But keep in mind that the neat thing about cap and trade and the multifaceted approach this bill takes, which also includes a large renewable energy standard for all utilities, that they have to get 20% of their power from renewable energy, is that it doesn't allow gimmicks to short-circuit the system. CAFE failed in terms of reducing our oil dependence because it exempted trucks for very good reasons. If you wrote that bill back in the 70s, you're like, well, I don't want Mack truck drivers to suffer. So what did Detroit do? It created the SUV, called it a truck.
That's right, the SUV.
And that's how CAFE was completely circumvented.
That's
so
true.
You put all your eggs in one basket, you're going to limit the effect.
I think people are always going to look for loopholes. When we come back, I want to talk about the loopholes that remain in the bill. There's still time to fix it in the Senate. What can be closed and what Virginia Senator Warner has done specifically on this. If you want to call in, folks, here's your last chance. 888-488-MARK. Back after this.
Listen to smoke before you give it a try.
Only you.
Don't play with matches. Don't play with fire.
Fire.
Cause there's nothing there for about 3,000. Nothing very nice.
For homeless mind.
So if a gorgeous force is what you desire, don't play with matches.
Don't play with fire.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
Fire.
Why don't you just wash your car at home?
When I wash my car, everything runs down the street and down into the storm drains.
With all the chemicals in the soaps and waxes, the last thing I want to do is poison my own drinking water.
At least here, it's all contained and recycled on site.
That's why I also take my car in for oil changes instead of doing it myself. I might take a chance on spilling stuff.
You know what the best part is?
What?
More time to kick back and watch the game.
How far would you go to protect the planet?
I want you to build an ark.
Here we go!
Okay, that's good.
Maybe there's another way.
People! The flood is imminent!
Is it too much to ask for a little precipitation?
Go to fightglobalwarming.com to find out what you and your community can do to reduce global warming pollution.
Somewhere around the world, there are men and women of the armed forces risking their lives, helping rebuild communities after natural disasters, collecting toys for needy children, tutoring kids in school. These are your sons and daughters who work to keep us safe, secure, and free. Dedicated men and women who put their country first.
Here again, the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. We're discussing the Obama energy policy. How is it different from past administrations? What is the cap and trade bill? How can it help fix global warming? And what else needs to be done? My guests are John Powers, sitting to my left. He is the Chief Operating Officer of the Truman National Security Project. To his left is Jim Morin. He is an attorney who's worked on a number of renewable energy projects. Gentlemen, the problem with any legislation, in fact, as Jim, you were just pointing out before the break, is that there are loopholes. In the case of car fuel efficiency standards, what do? They exempted trucks because they knew that trucks use up a lot of fuel. And then, lo and behold, Detroit created the SUV and called it a truck and got away from the standards. What are the significant loopholes in this cap and trade bill that either of you would like to see fixed by the time it goes through the Senate and becomes law?
I think the most important thing is that it becomes law. It's going to have warts on it, all legislation does. But what's critical is you create that structure in place that renewable energy developers, entrepreneurs realize that the Congress has put its money where its mouth is, that it's taken this problem very seriously, and that it's going to continue to take this problem very seriously for a long time to come.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think the opportunity, because the Senate hasn't passed this yet, to begin to really do the deep dive into this and fix it is here. And they're working on it now, and that's one of the reasons we've seen testimony over the course of the last few weeks to really delve into this issue to make sure we're addressing it.
Also, I can say as someone who's worked in Congress that sometimes there are 1.0s in legislation as well. The Environmental Protection Agency was begun under Richard Nixon. It wasn't perfect when it was developed. The Food and Drug Administration was begun under Teddy Roosevelt. If it's not working, you have passed more legislation, and you do executive orders, and you can fix it as it goes along. But if you do nothing, then the problem just festers. Still, you're going to hear a lot of critics talking about the cost to our economy. Here we are in the most dramatic recession since the Great Depression. There are a lot of suffering out there, the highest unemployment in 25-plus years. What is the cost to our economy of cap and trade?
I think it's an opportunity for our economy. As a guy from Buffalo, New York, a guy from the Rust Belt, a guy who's seen our car factories,
steel mills.
Oh yeah, steel factories go overseas. 3 out of 5 people my age leave Western New York because there's no job opportunities. It's a chance to go back into those crumbling factories and begin to set up factories that build solar panels, that build windmills. But again, if we don't act on it, China will. There's a group in Colorado right now called the Veterans Green Job Alliance, which is taking wounded warriors, training them in critical green job skills, and beginning to position them in opportunities that they can begin to work off the stimulus package that's coming in. And going in and installing solar panels, going in and evaluating people's homes to see how much carbon they're using. So as the carbon credits start to come forward, they can begin to tag it. They're beginning to work in on military bases because the military has facilities all over the country saying, they're finally saying, what is our footprint? How can we fix this? And you know, they just passed their first class vets that go through. 4 were homeless before they got into this, and now these guys are getting jobs.
Well, no, but it sounds too good to be true. I mean, after all, if it could have been done privately, the free market would have done it already, so there's going to be a cost to taxpayers, isn't there?
Well, I think the real cost to taxpayers will be in the tens and tens of billions of dollars if we do nothing. Because keep in mind, the worst thing to do in the situation is nothing, because all it does, as you said, is let that problem fester. And there's hard science to substantiate that. Large portions of Virginia Beach disappearing. Worse storms. Worse bug infestation in the Great Plains. And so keep in mind, this is, gets lost in the weeds sometimes, that the worst cost is doing nothing. But projections, they range in this bill, but most of them show for as little as a dime a day. The American economy can use its innovative ability, the talent of its young veterans and other young blue-collar employees to reinvent how we produce energy in this country and how we consume it, and in a way that, that just benefits us.
Whenever I look at great sort of economic changes in this country, there's always a cost of getting that infrastructure in. You know, I think about building the railroads in the late 1800s, building the interstate highways under Dwight Eisenhower. Today there is a gas station on every corner. There's not a fuel cell station on every corner, electric charging thing. That takes time. But, you know, there used to be a blacksmith on every corner. Because you had to shoe the horses, and hey, they lost their jobs, and we have less manure in our streets. But you know, these kinds of infrastructure changes happen. And what's interesting is that the government funded the railroads, the government funded the interstate highways. Now people say that the government shouldn't fund this next change. To me, they're not following history.
I couldn't agree with you more.
Exactly. You know, a century ago, this country woke up and realized it had gotten really big, really fast. Suddenly, it spanned the entire continent. We spent the last century figuring out how we were going to bridge that time and distance with planes, trains, automobiles, interstate highways. The story of this century very well might be realizing that we have to produce electricity with less carbon emission and use it more efficiently.
Now, John, you were telling me in the break about Senator Warner of Virginia. Mark Warner, to me, is the classic moderate. I mean, he's not a liberal Democrat. He's someone who's very much a centrist, someone who's very much a business person. What's his feeling on cap and trade?
Well, actually, the Warner who I've been working with is John Warner.
Oh, John Warner.
The former Republican.
Oh, okay.
He was also the,
fair enough, another Virginia Senator Warner.
Former Secretary of the Navy.
Right.
He is working with Pew right now and is going out specifically. He testified with
Pew.
Pew is
a research chief.
Yes, the Pew
Charitable Trust.
Pew Charitable Trust to go out and talk about this and help educate the American
public. So John
public.
Warner is doing this.
John Warner.
And he's not, now is he being funded by some wind solar-powered energy? Or,
no.
So what's his view? Why does he think it's necessary?
Because he understands that this is a national security issue. He, having been in the military, being a Navy vet, having worked in the Pentagon, seeing the numbers, seeing the fact that, you know, the Military Advisory Board from CNA put out just a phenomenal report about how this is affecting our national security. He says, you know, there's something he's got to fight for and something he's got to see change. And, you know, when he went in front of his own Republican colleagues last week and looked him in the eye and said, you are wrong on this issue. This is a national security issue, and we have to move forward and address it now.
Is he convincing anyone? Do you see some Republicans that are turning around?
You'd be amazed at the people that stayed in the room. For, you know, I don't know if you've ever been in a Senate hearing, but most of the senators ask a question and leave.
That's true. It's true. The House hearings, too.
Oh, no, absolutely.
And keep in mind, he's being joined by dozens of generals and admirals from the Army, Air Force, Navy, Marine Corps, who realize that this is a problem that needs solving.
Okay, but the polluters have a lot of money. The oil companies have a lot of money. They profit from fossil fuels. Heck, Saudi Arabia profits big time from fossil fuels, and they're spending a lot of money saying, it's okay, leave it alone, buy from us, everything will be just fine.
Well, keep in mind that, you know, Jim Woolsey, the former director of the CIA, I've been told his Prius that he drives has a bumper sticker, Osama bin Laden hates this car.
Yeah, that's
and I think that good. Says a lot.
And he says it, that we are funding both sides of this war. It's the first time since the Civil War that we as a nation, your viewers, are funding both sides of this fight. And it's critically important that we stop that. We cut off the funding that we're sending overseas that's being spent against our troops.
That's something that I think people really need to realize, you know, every time we spend all this money on oil, we are giving to, whether it's Iran or Venezuela or Russia, pick who you don't like, these are people who are, you know, shooting at our troops in
Absolutely.
Iraq and Afghanistan and frankly funding people like Osama bin Laden to attack us in the United States. You at the Truman Project have an operation called Operation Free.
We're about to launch Operation Free,
which is
a team of national security organizations and veteran groups that are going out to talk about climate change and energy from a national security perspective and helping to educate the American people, helping to educate policymakers to say, we have to act now. We have a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to move on this, and it's this year. We've got to act.
I probably should give full disclosure and say that I am a senior fellow of the Truman National Security Project, so I am a big supporter of, but tell, many people haven't heard of Truman, John.
Sure.
What is Truman?
The Truman National Security Project is an organization that works to train emerging leaders. We recruit, train, and position a new generation of progressives to lead on national security. So we have fellows, Jim's a fellow, I was a fellow. We have fellows who are in the Pentagon right now closing Guantanamo Bay. We have fellows working on the White House Security Council.
And why is it called Truman?
Because President Truman was one of the last, really the last president to look at our national security apparatus and say, we have to make major changes. We've got to create the not only the National Security Council, but find a way to balance the Pentagon with the State Department, work with international organizations like the UN, and find a way to have what is called now smart power. You know, having been on the ground, both of us in combat, it's not always the military that's going to solve these problems. We can be a tool, but we shouldn't be the only tool in the toolkit, and Truman understood that.
So what can someone listening to this program, what can they do to help, to get involved? I guess they could call their senator and ask them to support cap and trade. That would be a big thing, right?
Absolutely. They can go to the Truman website, trumanproject.org, and sign up. We have a newsletter coming out on Operation Free here in the next few weeks. Again, pay attention to Operation Free. We're going to launch a declaration of freedom to free us from fossil fuels.
And one of the things I like about the Truman Project is it's a centrist organization. They're Republicans, they're Democrats, they're
Absolutely.
Simply people trying to solve America's problems. They're not agreeing to any particular agenda of the left or the right.
That's right.
And we look at, one of the things that drew me to it when I first left active duty in 2007 was the way that they look at the problems on the full scale that they really are. They understand that, you know, defeating al-Qaeda isn't just about killing terrorists, it's about draining the swamp that terrorists thrive in by fighting climate change and worsening, reducing the problems that they feed off of. It's about energy independence, but also things like good public education and public health in this country that creates our soldiers that will protect us in the coming years.
It also is important to keep in mind the cost of doing nothing. You know, people often talk about the cost of doing this, the cost of doing that. The cost of doing nothing. Here we have Arctic ice that hasn't melted in, what, hundreds of years, thousands of years? And it's melting, and we don't necessarily know all the consequences to our globe. I have some people say, I've heard them say, well, there was an ice age back millions of years ago. And yes, there was, but that was before human beings existed. That was before we had coastal beachfront property. That was before we had homes and so forth on rivers, before hurricanes caused the damage they did. It would be a new world.
Absolutely.
And not a world that any of us would really want to live in. I guess the last question I have is, anytime you want to do something in the short term to affect the long term, it's kind of hard to see around the horizon. People are saying, well, it doesn't affect me now. I mean, my house hasn't been taken over now. In just a few seconds, why should we worry about the long term?
Well, for me, there are so many reasons to be concerned about this issue. I'm a person of faith, and I think that goes to it. But also as a veteran, those of us that survived, we know we have a duty towards those that didn't. And for me, this is a large part of that.
I think there's three pieces. There are energy security, our climate change, and our national security are all tied together.
And it's all about the future. I want to thank you both, John
you.
And Jim, for coming on The Inside Scoop.
Thanks, Mark.
If you want more information, go to radioinsidescoop.com and leave a comment there and let us know what you think. This is Mark Levine.